Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Are you looking for someone who understands the autism scene? Somebody who's also LGBTQ? Well, my next guest is an autism author, speaker, and consultant. She's been a teacher, a principal, and so much more. She's very understanding and compassionate about what she writes and who she helps. So sit back, relax, and grab your favorite beverage, and let's learn more about her. See you there.
I wanna believe in the truth, but only see what I'm shown. Got the freedom to choose, but can't decide on my own. Follow what the group is thinking, bottle up my intuition till it's popping out the box that I don't fit in.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Inside the Asperger Studios. Today I'm joined with Dr. Wendy. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Hi, Rita's glad. I'm so happy to be here. Please just call me
Okay,
Wendy.
so why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I started out my career for 20 years. I was a special ed teacher. For another 20 years, I was a school psychologist and became a licensed educational psychologist. And then after 40 years of working, and the last part of my career, the last couple decades, I specialized in autism in the schools. And then I retired. Retirement didn't really take with me. So first I started writing books about autism. I should mention my late husband and two of our three children, now grown, were all late diagnosed autistic people. Now I love writing books, so I'm up to I just turned in my 10th book to my publisher, all on different topics about autism. My favorite is one called Recognizing Autism in Women and Girls. And then I have a series, a 5-book series called Adulting While Autistic, talking about many different topics about adulting. And I also started seeing clients who later in life were realizing that they were autistic and they needed someone who could understand and kind of get behind that mask that they had been putting on forever. So now I have a nationwide group practice. I hire clinicians. Most of my clinicians are autistic themselves. I'm retired from actually working with clients. But I love being able to support these clinicians in having their job that they love and serving the clients that we serve to help them get answers. Why have I always felt so different? Well, if it's autism or if it's ADHD, we can help them get those answers. And that has really made my retirement a lot of fun.
I mean, that seems to be one of the big questions I seem to ask everybody after they get diagnosed is, did your world suddenly change when you found out you were autistic? And everyone had the same answer, yes, because it explained so much more to them about why their past was the way they were, why they did the things they did, why people looked at them differently. And when you're talking to somebody from the inside out, you see this yourself because you don't see what other people see, how you act. You don't until somebody brings it up to you.
Yeah, and I think that's true for many of us. Although, and certainly my late husband, when he found out after our kids were diagnosed that he was in fact autistic and had been autistic all along, it really was a wonderful, enlightening moment for him to look back and say, "There's nothing wrong with me. I've been doing great for someone with autism." But to realize that it's not something wrong. I think autistic brains are wonderful brains. And I think, Down syndrome brains are wonderful brains and, OCD brains. I think, and that's what the neurodiversity affirming movement is all about, is all brains are good brains. Let's not try to cure something. Let's try to make people's lives easier with the brains they have by not putting barriers up for them.
So when did your husband get diagnosed?
He was, see, my time brain is not working. Our youngest would have been like 13, 14. So he was in his probably 40s. And he'd always known that he was different. At one point, he and my oldest child were both diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder,
Okay.
OCD. So we used to think, well, everything that's different or challenging for them, it must be the OCD. But it turns out it was never OCD, or maybe OCD and. But autism just gave more answers. And it's like, okay, that fits.
I mean, what a lot of people don't realize is just, you may just be diagnosed with autism, but there's also sides of other things you get as well. OCD, ADHD, and these are other disabilities that kind of go along with autism.
Yes, that's so true. And we often see anxiety and depression are the first things that might come up. But I think living as an autistic person in a neuro-majority world would be anxiety-provoking and would be depressing if you're trying to talk to people and they don't understand you and they misunderstand your intentions. You know, so many people I've worked with, people are always getting mad at them and they don't know why. You know, my own husband, his mom was always saying, and his teachers too, oh, you're in trouble now. And he'd say, why? They'd say, you know what you said. And he didn't know because he was very literal. And they were like, when you say that literal thing, that means you're being smart with me and you're talking back. And if you ask me, what does that mean? Then clearly you're a smart aleck. So it was confusing for him when he was a child. But as he became a teenager, he kind of learned to go with it. He learned how to use it as humor on purpose instead of people just laughing at him and him being clueless.
You know, what a lot of people don't realize about us is the fact that you can say, if we do something wrong and then we don't know until later on, and then they come back and say, oh, you didn't, they call you into the office, you did this, this, and this. And you're like, did I? Why didn't you tell me there and then I did this, or to my face? I've had encounters where I volunteered at a museum where I get called into my supervisor's office and they'll go, Reed, we've been told that you don't, we don't, the volunteers don't like you standing too close to them. I'm like, why didn't they tell me to my face? Why didn't they tell me? And she's like, people don't like confrontation. And I'm thinking, how do you expect me to correct myself if it's not on the spot? And that's what they don't get. We forget from the moment it happens because other things are going on. Our minds are processing everything. We don't hold that one incident in their head.
Yeah. And if a neuromajority person has an innate sense of what's the right distance, they make an assumption that everybody knows that. And if anybody's standing too close, that means they're doing it on purpose. And that means maybe they're threatening. And if I confront them, it will make it worse. Instead of just the basic, let me know. I remember once after my husband had recently been diagnosed, we had bought something and there was something wrong with it. We had to go back and we didn't get back in line with the groceries because we weren't buying anything new. We just needed to stand nearby the cashier to be able to look and say, oh, we just need to fix this. And we stood and stood. I was kind of behind. He was closer. And then I realized that man's never going to see him unless David takes one step forward and to the left. So I just said, hey, do it. Take a step forward and to the left. And within moments, the person said, oh, can I help you? Now, to David, he thought he was as close as he needed to be. Whether it's too close or too far, it's that, you know, the perception. But once he got into the guy's peripheral vision, David's own peripheral vision is huge. He can see everybody on the sides. But a lot of us in the neuromajority have, you know, a more narrow vision. Yeah. So just knowing, stand closer, stand farther, is something that, you know, just tell people. And wouldn't that be easier?
Now, how old were your kids when they got diagnosed?
The youngest was about 13, 14. Mm-hmm. And then the oldest would have been already in college.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, I read your bio and you realize that women and those who were part of the LGBTQ community had trouble getting resources for getting tested and everything else. When did you realize this?
Well, as I was working with clients when I first retired, I kept hearing some of the same stories again and again. A woman would come and one woman said, you know, I went to my doctor and I tried to say I'm autistic and he immediately said, oh, you can't be, without even testing me. He says, because you looked at my eyes. Well, anybody can choose to look at someone's eyes, even if it's not their comfort level. And so many, especially people who were assigned female at birth and kind of raised to be girls and women, learn to mask. They learn to pretend to be what other people expect of them. So they get really good at masking and pretending to be normal, which I can't say normal without finger quotes. And they're so good at it that they can't get diagnosed. And there's a lack of awareness in the larger medical and therapy world of what autism is. And many of them have seen early diagnosed people who are identified as autism when they're 2 and 3 years old is going to be a very different person, perhaps, than someone who isn't identified till they're in their 30s. So if they look at that person and say, well, you can talk. You're married. One woman spent thousands of dollars, and at the end of it, the psychologist told her, "You all of the tests that I gave you passed. You were in the range of autism, but I won't give you the diagnosis because you have a job, you're married, and you looked at my eyes."
That's
Now, he already knew all that before he took all her money.
very ableist of
But I
him.
think we need to look behind the mask. Yeah, instead of, oh, you looked at my eyes, we could ask, did you teach yourself eye contact? Or do you have a system for eye contact? Or how does eye contact feel to you? Because as a neuromajority person, eye contact feels like nothing to me. And nobody taught me how to look at people's eyes. And when I look at people's eyes, I have zero emotion on it. It's like nothing. It's like breathing. But people I know who are autistic, they might have to train themselves to look at someone's eyes. They might say, oh, I'm going to look at the glasses. Or they might have a system. I'll look at the eyes for 3 seconds. I'll glance away for 4 seconds. I'll look at their eyes again. And they're counting in their head while they're having a conversation. You got to be smart to be able to do that. But it's exhausting. I can only imagine how tired they are at the end of a conversation of purposefully, and you can speak to this more than I can, I'm sure.
I mean, what people don't realize is we may not be looking at your eyes, but we're still listening.
Yes, exactly. We hear with our ears. And yeah, my oldest child in high school, teachers kept saying, don't take notes, just look at me. And as soon as he did that, he knew, well, now I'm not going to get anything. He could not understand or retain any of the information, and his grades suffered because every teacher that said, you must look at me while I'm talking, like he didn't get any of the concepts that were being
That
presented.
may explain to me when I was in high school why I was in a history class and we had to take notes when watching a history films, and why I couldn't for the life of me take notes from the film because I was forcing myself to watch the film to try to pick out these things when everyone else around me was able to do it.
And you were just as smart as they were, but it's a different processing, everybody had great brains, but your brain was different, and they should have made allowances and said, for you don't have to take notes while you're watching it. Maybe jot down notes afterwards of what you remember from it. But yeah, teachers do need to teach differently and allow kids to learn in their own way.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of a story I had with a client, a guest of mine, and he was talking about he was giving a speech to a bunch of autistics at the JCC. And at the end of it, he went to the woman that had sponsored it and everything. And she's like, how did it go? She's like, he went horrible. Nobody was looking at me. And she's like, you're wrong. It went great. They heard every word you said. They may not be looking at you, but they were listening to you.
Yes, and that's the important thing. They could have walked out if they weren't enjoying what they heard. Yeah, and I would love for more people to get that message. Is it doesn't matter if they look at you. It's are they with you? Are they listening?
So,
Yeah.
when did you start your autism assessment and services?
I was seeing a few private clients doing consultation before the pandemic, and then after the pandemic, I went to telehealth. Sorry, every once in a while I drop a word. I went to telehealth and started seeing people. And more and more people around the time of the pandemic were noticing at first when there was a lockdown, our autistic people were going, oh, thank goodness, I don't have to go into the office. I can work. I can be productive. I can get so much more done. And all of their coworkers were going, oh, this is terrible. I can't be with the other people. I can't, leave my house. And then at the end, so they were going, what's so different about me? And they were researching, and there were a lot of TikTokers and podcasters and bloggers who they could relate to, who they were autistic. So if they're autistic, maybe I am. Then at the end of the pandemic, when the lot was, I don't know if there'll ever be an end, but when the lockdown was lifted and people were being required to go back to the office, many of those autistic workers found that it was so oppressive and it was so difficult for them to go back. A lot of them were getting fired because they had been really productive and feeling good about the work they were doing when they could control the sensory, the light, the temperature. They could have their pet nearby or a blanket or something that helps them to focus and do their best work. But once they had to go back into the office, they lost all those supports that they had been able to provide themselves. And their job was not going to give them those supports unless they could say, oh, yes, I really am autistic. I got tested. So a lot more people. And that's when I started hiring, starting with people that I knew, and then just putting it out, like friends of friends. We only hire people that we like, and I'm very pleased with our little staff. We've got six clinicians, and they're licensed in all but like 10 of the states because many of them have multiple licenses. So, we can see we can't diagnose in every single state or do counseling in every single state, but we do have life coaches who are also autistic and who are also master's degree level. And they can see people in any state for life coaching if that's what somebody wants, dating coaching or time management, that kind of thing.
Now, you are a special ed teacher. First off, I have to give my hats off to you. I dealt with special ed in grammar school and high school. You guys put up with a lot because you dealt with not just one disability, you dealt with kids with several disabilities. Did you come across a lot of kids who were on the spectrum when you were a special ed teacher?
I believe that I did, but back then they were not diagnosed as such. I started teaching the same year that IEPs were required for the very first time back in the mid-70s.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm old. But back then we had to take a piece of blank paper, roll it into a typewriter machine, and just type it from nothing, just from knowing what is required in an IEP. We just had to have that knowledge. And then just there were no forms to fill out. It was just us writing the IEP. Within a couple of years, they had forms in triplicate for us to fill out. But back then, the IEP was new. So a lot of kids were being given special ed services for whatever disability they could latch onto, like a learning disability. But in looking back, a lot of them, honestly, some of my favorite kids. I look back and I go, oh, today we would diagnose autism. But they were interesting. I really loved my years as a special ed teacher.
All right.
And yeah, I thought I would do that forever. And then when the time came for me to go back to school and learn something else, it's like, okay, now the time is right. It's like yesterday I thought, no, I'll be a teacher forever. And today it's like, no, I'm going back to school. I'm learning the next thing.
Now you've mentioned you've written several books. What has prompted you to
Yes.
write those books?
Well, the very first one is probably the book I'm least proud of because at the end of my career, when I was becoming a licensed educational psychologist, I also went through the training and the supervision and the test to become a board certified behavior analyst. And by the time I completed that, I realized I didn't want to do that. I mean, I'm interested in the science of behavior as I can use it for myself. I'm not interested in using it against other, I say against, using it on other people to try to shape their behaviors in ways that they don't want their behaviors to shape. I've learned so much about the negative side of that. But at that time, the things that I'd learned about behavior, I thought, boy, when I started teaching, I wish I'd known this or that. So I wrote a book for teachers, kind of for my young teacher self to say, here's some helpful things that the science of behavior tells us that might help in your classroom. When I look back at it, I realize it's not as neurodiversity affirming as I believe now. So I wrote it as this is to help teachers. And now I'm thinking, boy, if I ever get a chance to rewrite it, it's going to need a total rewrite. But then after that, I wanted to write a book for autistic adults because I was parenting autistic adults and I could see what some of the needs were about independence. So then I started that path. And one thing about my books that I have enjoyed is I always come up with fictional characters. And for every chapter, for every topic, it's like, here's some stuff that I want to talk about, communication. Then I would take all these characters. There might be five, there might be seven. It's, consistent throughout the book. And for each of these characters, here's how this character, here's a challenge they had about communication and how they handled it. Here's how this other character had a different challenge on the same topic and how they handled it, to kind of demonstrate through reading stories ways that autistic adults were solving their own problems, just as a sort of an example. And I enjoy the fictional side of my non-fictional work. But even more important than that, for every chapter, I would include a little anecdote or words of wisdom written by actually autistic people, because I'm not autistic. Being married to one, being a parent, being an employer of autistic professionals, I'm still in the neuro majority. So I want to elevate the voices of actually autistic people in every one of my books so that those voices are heard, because that's important.
Now, let me go back a little bit. What was it, what
Sure.
is it like living with somebody who is autistic and raising two kids who are autistic, but not only that, but coming out as trans?
Well, it seems like it would be hard, and I have to say, I've been maybe I've just been fortunate to have the kids that I have. We were all locked down together during the pandemic, including my non-autistic child, I couldn't ask for better company. If I'm going to be locked down with somebody, it's going to be these guys, because they are kind and they do think about other people. There are certainly things that it's important for us all to be aware of. I have a son who can't stand the sound of people chewing. A lot of autistic people have that misophonia. It is not their fault. They just can't stand it. It's not saying you are a noisy eater, it's your problem. It's just, it's an issue. So we always have music or TV or something in the house when we're eating together. It's just the way that we take care of that. And what I've noticed is when I'm somewhere else, it's become so automatic that, like, if I'm in the movies by myself eating popcorn, there's a loud movie, and then suddenly it's silent on the screen, like maybe it's between one little commercial and the next trailer, I stop chewing. I just freeze until the sound starts up again, and then I start chewing again. I realize I've just trained myself that if it's silent, I'm not going to chew. And if I forget, one of my kids will say, oh, wait till we get the next show on. If I start to pick up a cracker or something, it's like, and I was like, oh, okay, I will wait. Usually I remember, but they remind me politely. But those kinds of things, I think any family can make the accommodations that are needed. It's not hard. It's just part of life of living with other people is being aware of what their needs are. And it's so much easier for me to not chew in a moment of silence than for someone who has something in their brain that makes that sound of chewing exaggerated in a way that it doesn't, it's not for me, but it is true for them. It's just so much easier for me to make the change.
Now, for your two kids who are autistic, how was the lockdown? Because when I've talked with a lot of people, they say lockdown either was good for them or it was bad for them. How was it for your kids?
Well, as far as I know, it was great. We did used to enjoy going to like Target together. We would like do a circle. It was always clockwise around the store. So we kind of missed that, but we got used to now we're going to pick up in the parking lot. I love parking lot pickup. I don't ever want to go back, honestly. And we can order, if we were going to go to a restaurant, we can order the same restaurant to deliver food for a special occasion at home. So we have done okay with the lockdown.
All right.
Everybody has their own room, so if they need to isolate further, they can.
Right, that's good. Now, what kind of recognitions did your books get?
What kind of what? I'm
Recognition.
sorry. Oh, well, thanks for asking. My first independent living with autism, so now it's the rewrite is called Independent Living While Autistic. But that one got the Chanticleer International Book Award grand prize. A couple of the others got a first. One that I wrote with my daughter, who's not autistic, is called, it was right at the time of the pandemic. It's called Homeschooling Autism Style. And we wrote that one in like in 2 weeks because suddenly all these parents were homeschooling. That one got a gold award from the Nonfiction Authors Association. And recognizing autism in women and girls, it did get a first with the Chanticleer, but it also got a silver award with the Sarton Book Awards, which is, even though it's a silver, it's a prestigious award, and I'm proud of that. So I enjoy the fact that other people might also like them. I liked writing them. So, I'm happy that people have liked them.
Now, from reading your bio, you mentioned you moved from California to Oregon. Why did you go across country?
Well, we chose Oregon when I retired because I have two sisters who live here, and it was just nice to be closer to family. Also, the climate in the little part in the center of California where we were, it was very dry and very hot, and it was a difficult climate for my kids and me to be healthy. We've all got a little bit of asthma, and in Oregon, the water falls right out of the sky for free. Right before we moved, our last 5 days, I had just retired. We were packing up everything. The last 5 days before we made the move, it was 108 degrees every single day, 5 days in a row in California where we were. And so every day as we were getting up, packing boxes, I'd say, okay, it's 100 day. But in Salem, Oregon, it's 78 right now. So that was we're going to a place where it will not be so hot. And it's, of course, climate is changing everywhere, but we're happier being with family and also being in a climate where things grow and we enjoy the surroundings.
Now, did you know your kids had autism before they came out as trans?
Yes. First, we learned that they were autistic when they were like 13, 18. And it wasn't until they were adults that they came out as trans. My youngest had not been aware that there was a thing called trans when she was younger. She just didn't know. And I think the understanding of gender was something that she took a lot of time with before she came out as my daughter, rather than the son that I thought that I had, but the daughter that is truly mine. And it was after that that my oldest, who had already come from, he was assigned female at birth. He'd come into non-binary and was using they, and then said, went from non-binary to like, at first it was like, well, 85% of the time she would be appropriate. But the other part of the time, he feels right. So we'll just use they. But then came to the point of, no, it's not they. It is now 100% he. He just knew who he was. And we were happy to do it. One thing that I think parents should probably do, I think parents should do, is I reminded my kids that when a new baby is born, they are showered with lots of new little baby clothes because they've never been born before. They didn't have any clothes. And therefore, we're going to get you some new clothes now that you've come out. Because they're not the kind of kids who are always saying, buy me this, buy me that. They're the kind that would not ask for things for themselves. So I wanted to make sure that they knew it is appropriate for me to buy you new clothes that fit who we know you are. This is just part of the celebration of congratulations. It's a girl, it's a boy. So I think congratulating and also celebrating with new clothes is just is the right thing to do for those, you know, parents, grandparents, family members, friends. We didn't have an actual shower, but it would be fun to have a shower where everybody gave the person clothes for their appropriate gender.
So how is your practice doing?
It's doing well. We I'm not seeing clients myself anymore, but I have a practice manager and a clinical director who are amazing. And we have room for new people. So if somebody wants to come and get tested, there's not a waiting list. We will get you in. It might not be today, obviously, but we will definitely can get people in if they have that need to find out, you know, am I autistic?
I think that's the biggest problem now in the community is getting tested. It's you want to get tested. Oh, okay, you got to wait so many months, or you got to pay so much. And I think the biggest problem isn't the wait, it's the cost.
Yeah, and I've had people really upset with me because they want it to be free, but I'm paying my clinicians and all my staff members, including autistic people. So they're saying, "Oh, you're disrespecting autistic people because we don't have jobs." Because I would be disrespecting my autistic employees if I didn't pay them sufficient, you know. So it does cost money. But there is available with us the possibility of an anonymous donor sponsorship where somebody might be sponsored for either 25% or up to 50% if the need is great of the full cost. Because a lot of people can't afford the full cost. And those who can afford it, that's great. And that can maybe help somebody else to get a sponsorship.
I mean, I kind of got lucky with my testing. I came across a clinical research for a drug for autism for communications. When I was
Oh.
scrolling for Facebook, I filled out the form and I didn't hear anything. And then a month later, I get a call. Are you still interested? And I'm like, sure. One of the things was you get free transportation to and from, which is nice. So my mom didn't have to drive me to and from. And then the other thing was, they said, before we even go through with this, we need to test you to see where you are. Little did we know it was a 4-hour test. They
Yeah.
divided my mother and I up because they said, listen, we want your true output of how you feel, where you feel you are. We don't want to know what your mother thinks. We want to know what you think of yourself.
So important,
And then that
yes.
kind of under then it kind of clicked in my head with my why, because they want a unbiased answer.
Yes, that is so important. Well, I'm glad you were able to do that. Yeah, we have like three sessions with the client before we can give the answer.
And then I got tested and put on the drug, and then at the end I became good friends with the psychiatrist who ran it. And
Oh,
then
nice.
they knew I was level one, but the problem is now I can't get the paperwork for it because it was done by a drug company and they hold the records.
Well, hopefully people will just believe you when you tell them, as they should.
Now, how important do you think it is that people get tested earlier than later?
I think with young children, because I spent a number of years testing 2 and 3 year olds, and the testing in the school system was to see if they were eligible for a preschool or an in-home program for autistic children. And we saw there were some really excellent teachers working in that County Office of Education in California at that time. And we saw that kids who were put into those classes made wonderful progress, and they were learning how to talk, and they were enjoying their life. I think a parent always has to look at how does my child feel in this program, because I've heard there are programs where it's very negative, it's very punitive, and the kids do not have fun. But the classes that I saw them in, they loved it, and the teachers just instinctively and through a lot of education and experience knew how to make learning fun and also really amplify their learning ability in a way that they couldn't have, like put them in a huge head start with 30 people. But in a small class, it was really important to get that identification early. Once someone is out of school, I think it's as important as the individual thinks it is. If they, and honestly, I don't think everybody needs a formal assessment. A lot of people know who they are. Mm-hmm. They self-identify, and I respect that. Nobody knows you better than you know yourself. It's only when there's some paperwork that's necessary that I think, yeah, somebody might need that. And some people just have, they just have self-doubt, and they want to hear that from someone else. One thing I've seen, depending on the state, if someone just has an autism assessment like we provide, where we do different autism questionnaires, tests, interview, observation, it might not be enough if they then go and say, oh, I want to get disability funding from the state as a disabled person. Some states are going to say, oh, but you didn't have an IQ test. You didn't have, you know, a neurologist doing this. We don't test IQ because when an adult comes to us, and typically they've been through school with no special ed services, and between our interview and observation, we can rule out what used to be called mental retardation, and now it's intellectual disability. That needs to be either identified or ruled out in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistics Manual, that we all have to use to check those boxes. We don't like the medical language that it uses in the DSM, like abnormal this and failure to do that. We like a more positive approach. But if somebody wants to get disability funding, which, you know, I'm all for, if somebody is disabled and needs funding, I'm all for that. But find out what your state requires before you get your assessment to make sure that it's what they're going to ask for. You don't want to get an autism assessment and then have them say, well, it wasn't a neuropsychologist, or it wasn't a this, or there was no IQ testing. I wouldn't need to give a person an IQ test when they come to me as an adult and we have all these conversations, and, you know, I don't need that to make the diagnosis. But if somebody is going to need services, they should, you know, find out ahead of time, what hoops will they make me jump through? Unfortunately, there are hoops to getting services.
So why do you think there are so many getting tested so late? Do you think it's partially because they're finally realizing, they either look back and look at their kids and realize their kids are autistic and they may be, or is it something else?
That's a lot of it. If they were able to, you know, pass and mask, and if they weren't getting in trouble in school, or if they got in trouble and it was just based on, oh, well, you're a naughty student, then no one would have thought of it. Also, the DSM, from like DSM 3, 4, 5, it has changed. And in the distant past, when like people my age might have, you know, and we've found people in their 60s who suddenly learned that they're autistic. But back then, the requirement for the boxes that you have to tick off to say, is this person autistic, required what they used to call mental retardation. If someone was, you know, of average intelligence or smarter, they could not get that diagnosis. They would call it something else. So, of course, they didn't get it. Also, back then, the standard recommendation was, if you have an autistic child, then what you should do and what your doctor will urge you to do is to give them up and have them put them in an institution, which a lot of parents would not want, and I don't blame them. And even though that requirement changed for the intellectual disability, a lot of people still have that old school idea that, well, they're smart, they can't be autistic. And it wasn't until fairly recently that they added and then took away Asperger's syndrome. I mean, they're still using it in England and, you know, Australia, but in America, that's no longer, now it's just the whole big autism spectrum. You're somewhere on it. You might be very smart. You might have intellectual challenges. But there's a perception that if they are acting like normal and going through school, then they can't be autistic, even though they are 100% autistic.
Now, why do you think there is such a problem with the LGBTQ community getting diagnosed with autism?
That is a good question. One thing I learned is that trans folk are 3 to 6 times more likely to also be autistic. But a lot of like parents and therapists and doctors of autistic people are less likely to believe them when they then come out as trans, but to say, oh, it's you just don't understand because you're autistic, so you're not. It's like they are. One mom I spoke to said, well, it's just that he went on, he's so easily led by, other people's ideas. And he was going on all these sites about trans people. So, of course, they were all trans. So he wanted to be trans too. Well, why do you think he was going on all those websites about trans? It's because he recognized something in himself. I want to say, I think this one was she. She recognized something in herself that her parent didn't. And it's not that, oh, she was led astray by other trans folk. No, that's not how that works. People don't choose to be gay or trans or autistic. It's in the brain, it's in the DNA. And maybe the little piece that says LGBTQ, and maybe the little piece in the DNA that says autistic, maybe they're next to each other on that twisty strand of DNA. I don't know, because that's not my expertise, but I imagine things.
Now, what advice would you give to those who are part of the LGBT community and those who are finding out later in life they are autistic?
Trust yourself and find people who will believe you, because you deserve, you know yourself better than anyone else. You deserve to live your authentic life as who you are. If you're autistic, be autistic out loud. If you're trans, if you're gay, whatever, wherever you are on either of those spectrums, you deserve to be yourself and to be respected and honored for that person.
And finally, where can people find out more about you and your services?
Oh, thanks for asking. My practice is at adultautismassessment.com. It's all one word. And my author website is my full name that I write under my grown-up name, which is WendellaWhitcombMarsh.com. And I can send you those if you want to put them in the notes, because it's kind of
Okay.
long.
And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Reed Miles. That was Wendy Marsh, and I'll see you in the next one. Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you. It was great to meet you.
Cause I